Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Larima, and I'm joined today by the Young Lions of the Institute of Race Relations, self-described. Mr. Gabriel Crowther. Gabriel, how are you?
I'm good. Feeling sunny, feeling like stretching my legs as soon as we're done here in the great outdoors.
Very good, because it is very cold up here in Joburg, and I think over most of the country. And the other person joining us today is, of course, Mr. Herman Pretorius. Herman, how are you?
I'm cold and glad to be here. And I recently moved into a new place in October, and an oil heater isn't one of those things you buy preemptively. So it really is a problem, but you know, so far so good. I'm moderately surviving. Last night when I was load shedding, I did have an emergency kettle boil so that I could just, you know, drink some tea and not, you know, die of, I don't know, hypothermia. But yeah, long story short, I'm good. Yeah.
Good. Well, I'm not so good, and I'll tell our listeners why. We just recorded, or we didn't record, 10 minutes of our show previously because I forgot to hit the record button. So we had a great conversation, which hopefully we will now equal. That was not recorded. But these things happen, I suppose.
You're a sport, Nick. You're a sport for admitting your faults and persevering nevertheless. We must persevere.
It's good. Examining our own sinful nature keeps us humble. Anyway. So you may see from the title of this episode, the quite clickbaity title, that our first topic of discussion today is the famous Dr. Anthony Fauci, who's become a polarizing figure around the world and has become extremely influential in how much of the global mainstream media in particular sees the COVID-19 pandemic. In the US, you have the left holding him up, or at least some of the left holding him up as a kind of patron saint of COVID and the antidote to all things Trumpy. And on the right, you see people holding him up as some sort of sabotager of the great hero Trump and a menace to all American freedom and society. It's a strange place for a public health official who is largely unknown before this pandemic to be. And so I guess one of the things we're going to talk about today is a number of news outlets got a freedom of information request granted to them, or at least partially granted, where they got a large number of emails from within the Trump administration while Fauci was working with Trump there. And these emails were basically them trying to find out whether Fauci was being pressured behind the scenes by Trump to say certain things. Gabriel will get into some of the details of that. But some interesting things have emerged about what Fauci was saying to the American public and to the world at large, because, of course, America set so much of the tone for our debates on things like COVID. Gabriel, would you like to repeat the wonderful talk you just gave that we didn't record?
Sure, no problem. Happy to say it many times. So I think the first thing to know about these emails, which were requested by CNN, The Washington Post, and BuzzFeed, is that although thousands have been released, they've been redacted. So we can't really see everything that's going on. Must be careful of reading too much into it, but what we can see is worrying. Okay, firstly, on the question of whether Trump was pressuring Fauci behind the scenes, both Trump's independence is vindicated, as is Anthony Fauci. Behind the scenes, he's very firm about the fact that he's standing on his own two feet and doing his own thing, and they disagree in public, and in private, they are both just getting along according to the rules and regulations of the game that they're playing. In other words, the reason that the FIRE application was made turned out to be not particularly significant if you compare it to the other revelations that have come from the emails. One of them is about masks, not necessarily the most important, but an indication of Fauci's character, which, as you say, has become the subject of great analysis both here and in America and around the world. So when the coronavirus first struck, the issuing guidelines were both from the WHO and from America's NHI under Fauci that masks are not very helpful. Don't worry about masks. And then a couple of weeks later, they said, no, that's actually not true. Masks are very important. Everyone must wear masks. And eventually they ramped that up to saying that it should be the law that you have to wear a mask, even if you're outside having a jog. Now, the WHO and the NHI, Fauci effectively admitted that they lied, but they said we lied for a good purpose. We were very worried that if everyone thought that they need a mask, they're all going to go buy masks. And it's even more important that nurses have masks. And so we'd run out of masks. So we had to lie to get people to not buy too many masks too soon. Once we got manufacturing ramped up, then we could tell everyone that masks are a really good idea. What the emails reveal is that Fauci not only lied, but he lied about why he lied. Because in his emails, he gives his honest view to his colleagues that he thinks masks are useless, at least useless to stop you from catching the disease. He says the viral particles are much too small. They can move through the filter of the fabric of the mask and have no real impact on your likelihood of catching the disease. He did say it's possible that it can stop you from spreading the disease. It reminds me of an old Spanish poet who visited New York in the 1930s and says, wonderful country. Everyone's like, they're all like children. They act out and they're very brash and they don't know how to cover their mouths when they sneeze or cough. They haven't been taught good manners. And so it seems like Fauci is thinking, you know, people can't like sneeze into their elbow or into their hand. So if you just give them a mask, maybe that'll be helpful for them. But for the rest, it's useless. That is his private view. Now, sympathizers for Fauci will say that, and have said already, that we shouldn't judge him too harshly. He was just reflecting the best understanding of the science at the time, that at the time people weren't sure that masks could help and that later on they figured out that they're super, super helpful and that he changed his views accordingly. That's just not really true if you follow the data into mask investigations. People have been wearing masks in medically intensive contexts for over a century, and certainly for the last 50 years, and that's been intensively studied. So most of what we know about masks and aerosols and droplets and the spread of viral contagion is stuff we knew from before the plague. That which we figured out subsequently doesn't really contradict it all that much. There hasn't been nearly the kind of shift in the data that one would need to justify this thought that Fauci was following the science. Really, Fauci was just clearly being a hypocrite. The third revelation, however, is much more profound. And this is to do with America's role in potentially aiding the creation of the coronavirus. The long and the short of it is that America had been funding a company called EcoHealth, which is run by a man called Peter Daszak, who I wrote about on the Daily Friend. And they were working in the Wuhan lab. And according to Peter Daszak's own words in the December of 2019, they were doing a great job of creating coronaviruses that could infect mice that had been sort of genetically engineered to be like human beings. So if this infects this kind of mouse, then you can be sure it'll infect this kind of human being. And the thought was, you know, if you can artificially create a virus that is a bit like SARS-1, if you can create SARS-2, then maybe you can get ahead of the curve in creating a vaccine. But that all relies on the virus not being leaked before you've created the vaccine, which is what might very well have happened. So Fauci's emails indicate that very early on in 2020, in around February, his colleagues drew to his attention the fact that genomic analysis of the SARS-CoV-2 virus indicated pro-tanto evidence that it was not natural, that it was in fact artificially created. Immediately thereafter, Fauci sends off some frenetic emails to other colleagues saying, look, we've got a lot that we have to do right now, and attaching documents referring to gain-of-function research that had been put on hold and then taken off hold during the Trump administration. So no one comes out of this looking good, neither Team Red nor Team Blue. Now, we're not sure exactly what those documents say because they've been redacted, but we do know that not that long thereafter, Fauci was making public comments supporting the natural origins hypothesis and discrediting the lab leak hypothesis. We also know that Peter Daszak, the very man who made a lot of money out of this kind of research more broadly, then sends Fauci an email to say, hey, thank you so much for supporting the cause, for convincing people that it's crazy. We mustn't think about the lab leak thing, and we should just suppose that it's a natural hypothesis. Now, just to spell out Peter Daszak's amazing accomplishments, although he worked with the Wuhan lab and therefore knew better than anyone else what kind of research that they were doing, knew better than anyone else that the lab director herself, as soon as SARS-CoV-2 was discovered in the wild, couldn't sleep for a week because she thought it might have leaked from her own laboratory, because it's the kind of thing that might have leaked from her own laboratory. He, in February last year, led a team of scientists to write a piece in The Lancet to say it's completely crazy conspiracy theory to think this could have come from the lab and no one should do that unless they're sort of racist against Chinese people. He didn't admit his conflict of interest, it being the case that it was kind of his lab. And he then got a position in the WHO to investigate himself. So he's an amazing guy. And the fact that he's thanking Fauci for help is an amazing thing. Now, this all sounds like very bad news in a way. And it might be bad news for Fauci. But I think it is part of a very good news story for the scientific community at large. Over the last few, at the start of the year, end of last year, I spoke to half a dozen scientists who said they strongly suspected some that the lab hypothesis might be true. Not that they're convinced it's true, but that they think it's a serious thing to talk about, but that they can't talk about it at risk of losing their jobs. That has changed in the course of this year. Scientists are now more openly talking about the hypothesis, more openly calling for further investigations into the hypothesis that it might have been leaked from a laboratory. And I think people are thinking, are more prepared to ventilate the facts. If it's the case that, as Niall Ferguson said, Chimerica has struck again, this sort of grand coalition between American money and American big ideas and cheap Chinese labor to do things that don't meet the highest regulations and standards, but do work very nicely for the already very wealthy. If this has in fact led to the death of 3 million people and the greatest economic collapse since World War II, we deserve to know. We deserve to look into what then needs to be done. But we can't do that until we're more confident than we are right now. So this kind of revelation is a step in the right direction. Next step really must be to disclose the other emails. There's just no good reason to conceal what Fauci was saying about the lab leak hypothesis in full. There's no good reason to conceal what was being said about gain of function research. In fact, if anything, there's an even stronger reason, because this research, if it was taking place, was taking place with American taxpayer money. And just after the email leaks, of course, a YouTube clip has emerged of Fauci saying, you know, his line has been, we knew we were sponsoring this stuff, but we hoped that there wouldn't be gain of function research. You can trust these guys not to do it. Now there's a comment of him saying, well, we expect that there might be some kind of leaks. I think the correct interpretation is some kind of leaks of that money from what we're asking for to what we're not necessarily asking for. So we've got to know. We've got to know more. And I think American senators and congressmen are pushing in that direction.
I think it's very good that the scientific conversation is opening up a bit. Herman, my question to you is this. It seems like one of the things that's through current here, not just from Fauci, but from other public health officials around the world, has been the idea that people are too stupid to make up their own minds when confronted with the truth, that you have to lie to them in order to make sure that they do the right thing for their own health. And I suspect that was part of the reason why they pushed back on the lab leak hypothesis, because they said some people will use this to make crazy conspiracy theories, therefore we can't tell people the truth about it. What's your view on that, Herman?
Well, I think one of the most interesting little facts to come out of the whole global coronavirus situation is a year ago with the very first, well, more than a year ago now, with the very first lockdowns, especially in America, data from Apple and Google indicate that ordinary civilians started limiting their movements and behaviors a week or two before lockdowns were starting to, you know, become the flavor of the month and the policy that everyone had to follow. So I think on that basis, there's some empirical reason to think, you know, perhaps people aren't as stupid as the bureaucrats think. Now, whether Anthony Fauci is a good guy or a bad guy, I don't know. And that's not really for me to decide. And I just don't know enough to make that call. But what I do know is that I find it particularly worrying, especially in what is supposed to be the greatest democracy in the world, something, a country based on a codified delineation and division of power, that in that sphere, you have people like Anthony Fauci essentially taking over government power, government decision-making power in a weird way. Now, as long as he's an advisor, that's all good and well. All presidents need advisors. All politicians should rely on experts. But a dangerous thing has happened in America and is, I'm afraid, happening in Europe and might start happening here, but I don't know, is that a fourth branch of government has been created. Traditionally, you've got three branches of state. You've got the maker of laws, Parliament or Congress. You've got the applier of laws, the executive, the union buildings or the White House. And then you've got the judiciary, the court, checking whether these other two are doing their jobs properly. And these keep each other in check. And the tension between them is absolutely vital to accountability and transparency and democracy. And what really scares me is that someone like Anthony Fauci, without any democratic mandate, with no scope for democratic accountability, is in a position to make decisions that by right should be the province of elected or at least constitutionally mandated people. So in America, you've got the existence of a fourth branch of state, the bureaucratic branch of state, where cowardly democratic institutions over a century have outsourced and outsourced and outsourced decision-making power to non-governmental, non-constitutional bodies. And you end up in a situation where someone like Fauci can have this level of power. If he is going to be a political actor and he's going to make political decisions as to whether a piece of information going out publicly will make the political system weaker, then he must stand for office. But what we are now faced with is a situation where a supposed independent academic, scientist, medical practitioner gave advice that wasn't medical. That gave advice that wasn't scientific, but was actually political, in that we shouldn't trust the people with this knowledge. It wasn't his call to make. And there's no avenue to hold him accountable or to punish him for that. And it's not, sadly, his fault. It's the failure of 100 years of politics where citizens have created a political class and where the political class have ensconced themselves to get the support from the voters, but not the responsibility or the accountability. So I think it's a systems failure that I hope can be addressed.
Yeah, I think that's pretty well said. Gabriel, any final thoughts on this topic before we move on?
Yeah, let's just bring it back home a little bit. We have Zweliem Kize with Digital Vibes and Anthony Fauci, who is like America's Zweliem Kize. And what's analogous and interesting is that there's a difference between science, which is to say a method of triangulating from different perspectives onto one and the same only world that we all co-occupy, and scientists, doctors, professionals, people that don't necessarily tell the truth and don't necessarily have everyone's best interests at heart. Now, my worry is that in the process of discrediting particular scientists, we end up discrediting science itself. And science, the idea that we all live in the same world, is strangely unfashionable. There are great currents. We talk a lot about critical race theory, but it's not the only one, which have increased this belief in sort of a kind of personal truth, a kind of an occult reality where what I see is not the same thing as what you see. And you can't really build policy out of that. And you certainly can't get along with your neighbors very easily if you don't sort of accept that there's one street that's kind of made out of the same stuff from whatever perspective you're approaching it on, that you cross to find each other in the space of reason. So I hope very much that we can resist the temptation to give up on science and instead go for proper policy reform, both here and there, and also proper accountability. And in that regard, South Africa is not looking good. I think Fauci is more likely to be removed than Zweli Mkhize, even though Fauci is, as Herman says, in a systemically stronger place.
The problem that really grinded my gears for the whole of last year is this absolute binary nature of public discussion. You are either pro-Trump, thinking he is the second coming, or you think he is Hitler incarnate. You either think COVID is the end of humanity or the sniffles. There's no, and this aggressive commitment to the extremes, and that's the thing that's sort of dangerous here. On the one hand, this is going to become a Trump was right, Fauci was wrong thing. While it actually should be more nuanced than that, it's not our expert scientist, screw you, mark to the Trumpians. It's that the system fundamentally has failed people, and that has allowed extreme voices on all sides to just become dominating and aggressive. But I mean, the QAnon comments on this episode itself will be something to behold.
I look forward to them. Right, let us move from America to Israel, which we, of course, talked a little bit about in the recent month. But interesting political development there, and one of the big figures on the world stage, Benjamin Netanyahu, more commonly known as Bibi, looks like his 12-year stint as Prime Minister of Israel may be coming to an end. He's dominated Israeli politics for a very long time. He's managed to hold on to power despite many setbacks, despite many people becoming very opposed to him. And as a result of his efforts to kind of hold on to power and the opposition's inability to form any sort of front against him, there have been, I think, four Israeli elections in the last 2 years. And it looked like Israel was heading for a fifth because no coalition government could be formed. And yet, at the last sort of minute, looks like Benjamin Netanyahu's opponents have managed to stitch together a coalition that will muster a majority in the 120-member parliament of Israel. The coalition consists of 8 parties from across the political spectrum who are united basically only by their dislike of Benjamin Netanyahu. And they've decided that there will be a rotating prime ministership where Yair Lapid and his main coalition partner Nalafli Bennett will swap. So one of them will be prime minister for 2 years and the other one will be prime minister for 2 years.
If it lasts,
it's a little bit of a shaky agreement. Yeah, it's a little bit of a shaky agreement. Let's see if it actually goes on that long. One of the interesting developments of this is despite the recent conflict there, it looks like an Arab party is going to form part of this coalition, or at least supply some votes for it, which will be a first in Israeli politics, where the Arab parties have tended to not be included in any governments or governing coalitions. I think it's quite an interesting development in their parliament there. Gabriel, I don't know who to start with here. Let's start with you, Herman. Herman, Benjamin Netanyahu has been very good at wriggling out of these things in the past. Do you think he's going to get out of this one? I see that the opposition has called for a quick vote in parliament to try and topple him before he can do something.
There's now about a period of 2 weeks for this new coalition to assert its legitimacy as a majority in the Knesset. The problem here for them is that they're up against probably the stereotypical dirty fighting, street fighting, cunning politician on the world stage. I mean, only someone like Angela Merkel reaches the longevity of office that Benjamin Netanyahu has achieved. And she at least did it with most of the time something resembling a majority mandate. In his case, for 12 years, I mean, his rise to the prime ministership was surprising in 1996. So Netanyahu is not someone to take lightly. And I would I wouldn't be surprised if he manages to cobble one or two Knesset seats away from the coalition in the next 2 weeks. Now, I don't think it's likely, but there is a possibility of that. But to Gabriel's point about if it lasts, these sorts of design things never really make it in the world of rail politics. Locally, you can look at the government of national unity and we will share this and we will share that. It never ends well. It never ends well. The only country where coalition government works sustainably, I think, would be something like Australia, where both parties know for 70 years now what they're heading in for. And I wouldn't be surprised if this majority collapses before even the first cycle of that prime minister shuffle kicks in.
Yeah, I think that's probably very likely. Israeli politics is very fractious, and coalitions governments fall all the time, or at least parties change all the time and go up and down. But Netanyahu has been the one constant that's remained through all of it. Gabriel, your thoughts?
Yeah, nothing to add really, excepting I think it will be really positive if an openly Arab party is part of the governing coalition. And I think that security is going to be a major concern. And politicians play a role, but the military is also its own thing. Maybe it can hold itself together through a bit of political instability for the next few years. It's certainly been a lot of political instability for the last few years. But watch this space. Benjamin, Bibi might wriggle out of it.
He has done it before. Let's see if he can do it again. Anyway, we don't have much time, but I just want to briefly move on to our last story, which is that the Black Business Council's president, Sandile Zungu, has said that Black economic empowerment targets are not ambitious enough in South Africa, and that currently all these targets do is, quote, accommodate Black people through corporate restructures, whereas the country needs economic restructuring. He says that South Africa needs to transfer 70% of all ownership and management control of the economy into Black majority hands by 2030. Gabriel, your thoughts?
Yeah, I debated Mr. Zungu on TV for an hour a month ago. And after about 5 minutes, he started calling me a racist. And here's why. I started out by saying Stats SA shows that although in 1994, white people earned about 85% of national income, by 2015, Black people in the broader definition earned 70% of all income. So we've already reached that point of, 70% of the economy being controlled, as it were, by Black people. He's obviously talking about something a bit more interesting. And I think as someone said, it sounds a little bit like he wants to be in control of 70% of the economy, which I suppose would be an attractive idea to anyone. I think it's worth really knowing how dangerous it's funny, but it's also really dangerous. I mean, just yesterday, I think Daily French Show covered this case where Black shareholders were prevented from being able to sell their property because they wanted to sell it to white people. Now, this is the 1910 Land Act all over again. Being Black in South Africa, I mean, it doesn't matter what the government is. It's like, for the last 100 years, pretty much without fail, with a small little interregnum, people won't take you seriously when you say, I want to own this. 20 million people, 23 million people don't own the homes they sleep in because it's owned by the government, can't sell it. When people do get leases, they get removed. When people do manage to buy shares in a big company, then they're not allowed to sell them when they like. All because someone like Mr. Zungu has an idea, a very big idea, very exciting idea. And it's a very dangerous bloody thing, and it's worth opposing.
Definitely. Herman, in 30 seconds, your thoughts.
I just want to give one fact. BEE officially begins as government policy in 2005. Black unemployment in that year, 31.5%. It's now above 37. So in the 15 odd years that BEE has been government policy, the Black unemployment scene in South Africa has gotten worse. So let that speak for itself.
Well said. I'd like proponents of BEE to point out one economic success. Anyway, that's all the time we have for today. We will see you next week. We hope you enjoyed the show. And yeah, please like, comment, subscribe, share the podcast, the video, all that good stuff, and have a wonderful weekend. Cheers, everyone.